This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 35 million Americans suffer from depression severe enough to warrant treatment at some time in their lives, according to a study that was released last week, sponsored by the National Institutes of Health. The study also found that 60% of the people who seek treatment for their depression don't receive adequate care. My guest, Dr. Samuel Barrandes, is the director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. His new book is about antidepressants, how they were created, how they work, and how they may be improved in the future. The book is called Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. Dr. Barrandes is also the author of a previous book about the genetic links to mood disorders. You point out in your book that not all drugs work for all patients. And about one out of three people with major depressions don't get much benefit from the first antidepressant that they're given. Why is there such variation?
We don't know. I think that's one of the real puzzles about this disorder. One can speculate that different people have different underlying biochemical abnormalities, and so that different drugs might control them differently. But the answer in simple is that we really don't know. The fact, though, is that some people won't respond to one drug and will then respond to another. And we don't really understand why that happens.
So you're often in the position of trying one drug for a few weeks or a few months and then changing it until you get results.
That's right. There's a lot of trial and error in the treatment of this disorder, although a lot of people respond to the standard drugs very well, so that it's not completely haphazard. But if one drug doesn't work, the experience says, don't give up, try another one.
Often with antidepressants, you need to take them for a period of weeks before you get any positive effect, if in fact you're going to get a positive effect. Why does it take so long for the antidepressants to begin working?
That's one of the great mysteries about these medications. We have a general answer for this, which says that it takes a while for the brain to adapt to the changes in its chemistry which the drug produces. Because the drug does produce chemistry changes very promptly. That is, Prozac, for example, changes the way that the brain deals with serotonin very quickly. But then over the course of weeks, the brain adapts to this disturbance, to this change in its chemistry. And that presumably is where the therapeutic effect comes from. But that's just speaking in great generalities. The reality is that we don't know the specifics of this therapeutic effect, and finding out those specifics would be enormously valuable in making for better treatments for this disorder.
Now, you say that, you know, originally doctors believed that drugs should be prescribed only for disabling depressions.
Yes.
How much has that changed? It seems to me a lot of people who don't exactly have disabling depressions are still taking antidepressants.
It's changed a great deal. It used to be that only people who were suicidal or were just so completely depressed and incapacitated were treated with medications. The notion was, in the 60s, for example, that everybody else should be treated exclusively with psychotherapy, and that tampering with people's brain chemicals was something that should be avoided at all cost. Over the years, and particularly as drugs with lesser side effects were developed, Prozac being the most stunning example, although it's certainly not free of side effects, as drugs with lesser side effects, which people were more willing to take without complaints, were developed, the severity kept going down, so that now people with mild to moderate depression are frequently treated, and frequently with considerable benefit, by these psychiatric drugs.
What are the side effects that cause your patients the most trouble?
Well, initially people complain of nausea sometimes, difficulty sleeping sometimes, even increased nervousness sometimes. It varies from person to person. Over longer periods of time, the most common complaint is some sort of sexual dysfunction. A significant, but by no means all people, a significant percentage of people complain of either some loss of interest in sex or sexual incapacities of various kinds.
This is men and women?
Men and women, yes.
And does their sexual feelings return when they stop taking the drugs, or is this a more permanent side effect?
No, it's not a permanent side effect. It is reversible if the drug is stopped.
do you ever see cases where you think somebody has changed too extremely, that they're no longer themselves?
Well, I think that that does happen. And in fact, there can even be very distressing changes in people. In people who have a propensity to not only have depression, but manic episodes, some people who take these medications can actually become manic, can become irresponsible, can start spending money all the time, can start being hypersexual, in that sense can be no longer themselves. Of course, what a self is not a constant matter. We all are somewhat different selves in the course of the day and in the course of our lifetimes. We have a large repertoire of behaviors, but these drugs can push one in certain directions, and sometimes that result is extremely pleasing or relieving to people, but in other circumstances, it can be quite distressing, actually.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Samuel Berendez. He's the author of the book Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. He's the director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. Antidepressants are pretty new. Before the 1950s, what we had mostly was sedatives, like phenobarbital. What did the sedatives do, and what were they prescribed for? What kind of psychological problems were they prescribed for?
Phenobarbital was used for everything in the 30s and 40s. It was sort of the wonder drug of the time. So whatever ailed you, whether you were nervous or depressed or psychotic, phenobarbital was a very common medication. And there were lots of people taking elixir of phenobarbital or pills, phenobarbital pills. It was an extremely widely used, one-size-fits-all medication for mental distress. And family doctors were amongst the biggest prescribers. So it was sort of the drug that one used whenever anybody complained about some sort of problem.
Like what kind of problems?
Well, like being nervous, or like being tired, or like being worried, like staying up all night and worrying, which can be a symptom of depression, like being reluctant to go to work. That is, whatever bothered you, the medicine that was most readily available to family doctors was phenobarbital. Psychiatrists, of course, were extremely reluctant to use phenobarbital except as a sleeping medication, because they, in that period, believed that the great treatment for whatever ails you is psychotherapy. So that there was a real split in the way that the medical profession was organized.
Now, how do the antidepressants of today, you know, the Prozac type of drugs,
yes,
relate to the earlier antipsychotics and anti-anxiety drugs?
Well, the interesting thing about the antidepressants is that they, or the ones that we use today, is that they can trace their origins to the desire by a pharmaceutical company to make a drug as a competitor for the phenothiazines like Thorazine, Chlorpromazine. So the story goes this way. Thorazine was originally designed as an antihistamine, as a cold remedy, and it was only by chance that it was discovered to be useful in the treatment of psychosis. And so as soon as that was discovered, and as soon as Thorazine became an enormously popular and profitable drug, other pharmaceutical companies became interested in copying it. And so a company named Geigy in Switzerland looked in its storehouse and found a drug that looked very much like chlorpromazine called imipramine. And so they sent it to psychiatrists and said, try this out. Maybe we too can gain a large share of the market for this important new medication. But amazingly enough, it did not work on psychosis or schizophrenia. It did, however, also amazingly, relieve depression. And so out of the desire to make a me-too drug for the treatment of schizophrenia, came imipramine, which is the progenitor of most of the antidepressants that are used right now, including Prozac.
How does it work?
It was an accidental. How does it work? Okay. We know a little bit of how it works. We know that when imipramine is given to people, that it increases the effectiveness of certain brain chemicals, namely the chemicals called serotonin and norepinephrine, which are normally present in our brains and which we normally use to communicate all kinds of signals many of them of an emotional content. So when you take that original drug, imipramine, what happens is that norepinephrine and serotonin hang around longer, work more effectively in the brain. Once that was discovered, the pharmaceutical companies started looking around to see if they could perhaps try drugs which affected one or the other. And the driving force in that instance was to reduce side effects. That is, the more specific the drug, that is, the more specific its effect on individual brain chemicals, the better it might be. And in the quest to find a drug that was very specific for serotonin, the Lilly company discovered Prozac.
I guess I don't feel like I really understand what serotonin does in the brain.
Right. Well, it does an enormous number of things. Serotonin is one of these chemicals that controls a variety of behaviors. And it does this by affecting 14 different receptors that are scattered throughout the brain, which means that its effects are enormously complicated. Lots of chemicals affect only one receptor located in one specific place. Serotonin spreads out all over the brain, that is released from the terminals of nerve cells all over the brain, submits signals to various nerve cells that are scattered hither and yon that have different receptors, all of which respond to serotonin. And the net effect of all this serotonin output can be enormously complicated. And when you take Prozac, you augment all those effects, and amazingly enough, the outcome of this great change in the brain chemistry is therapeutic, especially over the course of weeks, as you pointed out before. So in very well-controlled clinical studies, the drug has been shown to be effective and helpful for a large number of people, although not without some side effects.
Medicine is still in its like early stages of understanding brain chemistry. Does it make you nervous as a doctor to prescribe drugs when scientists still know so little about how they work, and scientists know so little about the chemicals within the brain?
Yes, it does. But this is true not only of psychiatry; it's true of all of medicine. You may recall that the wonder drug that's in everybody's medicine cabinet, aspirin, which was discovered by chance in the latter part of the 19th century, was a completely mysterious drug until its mechanism of action on the body was discovered in the 1970s. So that for 70 years or so, people were taking aspirin by the bucketful, and doctors were prescribing it glibly, and people were prescribing it themselves, that is, were going to the local drugstore and buying the stuff, and nobody really understood how it worked. I mean, much of pharmacology is based on observations which in recent years are supported by carefully controlled clinical trials, that it works and that the benefit exceeds the downside. But taking a complicated chemical and putting it into the body does all kinds of things, and figuring out all of them is really extremely difficult. So this is the state of the art in medicine, in psychiatry, but also in medicine in general. Now, there are some exceptions. There are some drugs that we understand rather well, but much of pharmacology, even today, even in this modern era that we are so proud of, many of these medications work in poorly understood ways. So psychiatry is not at all exceptional in that regard.
You write in your book, Better Than Prozac, that pharmaceutical companies are focusing on improving the current antidepressant and anti-anxiety drugs as opposed to finding new ones. Why is that?
Well, I think they are trying to do both, but improving the current ones is a much surer thing. That is to say, once a market for a specific kind of drug is established, if you can just tweak it a little bit and get slightly better side effects or slightly more efficacy, you can gain huge market share, and doctors will be eager to prescribe the new variant if there's reasonable evidence that it's better, without the reluctance that might come from trying a new medication. It's also really hard to find something new. Remember, Prozac-like drugs came from tweaking imipramine, which was discovered by accident. It was an antihistamine. Finding really new classes of drugs is extraordinarily difficult. And so pharmaceutical companies are very inclined to make big investments in getting something that's a little bit better than what's already out there, and are worried about trying to find something completely new, A, because it might be more difficult to market, but more importantly, because it might be very difficult to find something from scratch that's really new and that really works. On the other hand, in instances where that happens, they've got a new blockbuster on their hands.
You think that the next frontier for antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs will be genetic-oriented drugs. What are some of the possibilities for the future?
Yes. I think in the long term, genetics is going to help us enormously in understanding why certain people are prone to become depressed, whereas others in the same life circumstance go on their merry way. That is, there is clearly a difference amongst people in their propensity for depression or anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder or schizophrenia or whatever psychiatric disorder you may think of. In each case, there's clear evidence that there's some familial component to this, that it runs somewhat in families, and that there's some genetic variation that makes people vulnerable to the particular condition. So now that we know so much about the human genome, and now that we're in a position to learn more about the genetic variations that each person has, a huge effort is being exerted to find out why certain people are prone to the various psychological ailments, just as a huge effort is being put out to find out why people are more prone to develop diabetes or high blood pressure or whatever. Just as those diseases have genetic underpinnings, so too do all the psychiatric diseases, including the lesser ones like moodiness, etc. So in the end, as we learn more about genetic variations amongst people, we will be in a position to learn what the circuits, what the genetic circuits in people's brains are like, as well as the genetic circuits in their bodies, and how they make these vulnerabilities exist. And that, in turn, will lead to the development of new specific medications for people who have specific kinds of genetic vulnerabilities.
This is going to be a difficult question to answer because it's so broad. But when you're seeing a patient for the first time, what criteria do you use to decide whether the person should receive medication or not?
Well, assessing a person is a complicated thing. My inclination when seeing people is to assess their strengths and weaknesses, and not intervene at all if it's not necessary. That is, I don't assume when I see a person that they need either psychotherapy or pharmacological therapy. My hope is that a small amount of conversation is all that's necessary to have them reoriented and get on their way. I don't sit there expecting that this person has a brain chemical problem that I've got to fix, or this person has a deep-seated psychological problem that I got to fix. I hear out what the problem is and then try to respond accordingly.
Dr. Berendez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Dr. Samuel Berendez is the author of Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. He directs the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco.